Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithel Day. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers for ATQ, Slurms Matt Court. How you doing?
Doing fantastic, sir. Yourself?
Not bad.
Good.
So the Diamond Ducks are rolling on. Both teams seem to be doing pretty well this season. The softball team just finished up beating one of their rivals, the Oregon State Beavers, in Corvallis. The first game got rained out on Friday, but they made it up with a doubleheader. Although Beavs, I guess a poverty program, couldn't afford to televise the second game. So I have no idea how that went.
They went over their 120 minutes a month on
live
streaming.
Poverty program that can't pay for the premium plan. And couldn't even pay a photographer. Like, there's no clips or still photos on Twitter or nothing.
There was very little of anything in that game, including on Oregon softball Twitter. There wasn't a ton of stuff on some of the games either.
Yeah, so I don't get it, man. Crazy. It must be a rights issue, I guess, but who knows? And it's weird too, because, so the first game, went down exactly as you expected, given that, actually, let me set the table a bit and talk a little bit about game theory, because who isn't excited about game theory?
Exactly.
For everything that happens in the diamond, baseball and softball, it's just about pitching versus batting, and fielding and base running are the tertiary questions, but the primary questions are simply your batting average, or if you want to get a little more technical, your on base percentage, or maybe OBV plus slug, versus the ERA is the classic measure of pitching performance, but maybe people have been looking at WHIP scores, but basically, how well do you bat versus how well do you pitch? But really, those are mirror images of each other. And then base running versus fielding, which again are sort of mirror images of each other. And look, Oregon's a more athletic team than Oregon State is. And so they enjoy a little bit of advantage in terms of they don't make mistakes, in terms of fielding, and they do squeeze out a couple extra steals and base running advantages. Whereas Oregon State does make mistakes in terms of, fielding, and they don't squeeze out extra advantages in terms of base running. And so, we definitely saw that all over the first game, right? Like yes. all yep. over the case in the first game where, you know, in fact, like I think I commented and I think you commented in your write-up where it's like the official scorekeeper in Corvallis marked down the Beavs as only like four errors. But like, right. I think there should have been like six or seven errors for the Beavers. Yeah. They were constantly biffing it on the field. Don't
there
you think?
Just there are a bunch of plays where, and I think this goes back to what you said about the athleticism gap there, where the defensive player for Oregon State simply could not get to the position she needed to be in to make the play. And so you had balls caroming off of gloves, balls falling next to people. It was crazy.
But honestly, that stuff, it's a tertiary question to the primary question of bats connecting with balls.
Right.
You know, because like it doesn't matter how well you field or how well you run the bases. If you're not, you know, if you don't connect with the ball in the first place, like, right. you know, if you're not putting the ball into the field to play, it doesn't matter how well you play the ball once it's in the field, or how well you run the bases, you know, once you're on the base. So like, and, you know, just going over the stats going into the game, you know, Oregon's cumulative batting average is just way better than Oregon State's cumulative batting average. And, you know, Oregon's, you know, pitching, as much as we've sort of discussed the fact that like Oregon's got like 1.5 ace, maybe, right. you know, Oregon State's got zero aces, you know, yeah,
exactly.
You know, like, you know, just the, you know, the essential question of a softball game or a baseball game of like, you know, our team hits better than you pitch and we pitch better than you hit. Like, you know, this should have been a sweep.
Right.
And it wasn't. You know, the first game looked like how you expected it to look, because, you know, where it was 10-4, where, you know, the better hitting team and the better pitching team and the better base running team and the better field, you know, fielding team, you know, just clobbered them. And it was like, it was almost not worth watching the game, except for it was a rivalry game. It was fun to watch them suffer. but then the second game didn't go that way.
No.
And it's hard to understand why, and no one can really answer why, because no one was able to watch that game except for the 30 brave souls who went out into the drizzle and watched it in Corvallis and left the comfort of their sheep at home. and like, I guess we could find them and ask them, you know, if they're capable of speaking the Queen's English. But like, who knows? Because like, that game was like, I mean, I'm looking at the box score and it's miserable. Oregon got two hits. In the entire yes. game, like, or yeah. one hit. Somehow they got two runs on one hit, and yeah. while Oregon State committed no errors, which, like, I don't understand how that happened.
I don't either. I mean, after their performance in the first game, suddenly they were able to field basically everything Oregon was able to put in play. You know, and the Ducks ended up getting, I think, a run on a wild pitch or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's a walk and a wild pitch in the same. Yeah. Game. Which is like what? Like what?
Yeah, but and no hits. yeah, so no. it's like very odd box score for that game.
Yeah, just and completely ice cold bats, just yeah. freezing yep. ice cold bats. But Oregon, the Ducks, pitch a shutout. They give up four hits, but like none of them score.
Yeah, you know, they're scattered the all over the.
Yeah. Right, exactly. The Beavs strained, but you know, four hits is still actually a pretty decent pitching performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, but that's what happened when Hansen got in trouble in the bottom of the seventh and leadoff double was given up.
Right, exactly. I mean, Stevie Hansen, I mean, credit to her. I've sort of been during all of conference play. I've been kind of like worried about Stevie Hansen this whole time. And yes. yet she basically pitches a shutout, you yeah. know, up until that seventh inning in which, you know, what happens because Oregon hasn't built up enough of a lead. Because so now the instant somebody gets on base, you know, that's the tying run,
yeah.
you know, comes up to the plate. And so, you know,
they showed in that series that Oregon State could hit home runs. So it's possible right. for the person coming to the plate to tie the game with one swing.
Right. So then Reagan Breedlove comes up, and now, you know, I'm even, you know, more worried because, you know, Reagan Breedlove of Oregon's like three pitchers, you know, three primary pitchers, like she's, you know, sort of the lowest on the pecking order, but she gets the save, you know, and good for her. But like, it really, you know, in a game where it's a shutout, I should be talking about, hey, what an amazing pitching performance.
Right.
But really, yeah. You know, it's the ice cold bats.
Yes.
And that sort of, you know, becomes a presage for what happens in the third game, which is televised. But like, nobody wants to talk about it because it was just gross. Like, yeah, Oregon just did bad. Not. I mean, Oregon just like didn't get, you know, that's a game. They get two hits in the entire game. Mm-hmm. It was just like gross. Like they just could not connect. And it's not like, you know, Oregon State's bullpen is this amazing bullpen or anything.
The interesting thing about these two games is for Oregon State, they were both pitched by the same person.
Right.
And she clearly was having a fantastic weekend. And in a way, I think the scheduling that had to happen because of the rainout on Friday kind of made that happen. I don't understand. I suppose what it means is that the coach didn't feel comfortable bringing Morgan Scott back on Sunday after she pitched the first game on Saturday, which is unfortunate. If she'd pitched the first game on Friday instead of Saturday, she would have had that one extra day of rest, and maybe she would have been able to pitch game three.
I mean,
now again, you're right. It wouldn't have made any difference. Nobody.
Yeah, exactly. There's no pitching performance that wins a game in which Oregon plates no runs.
Right.
You know, might be like
able to get it into extra innings until people shake out of it, but for crying out loud.
Yeah, no, I put 0% of the loss on Reagan Breedlove, you know, giving up four runs on five hits. Runs on five hits is fine. Like, yes. You know, like, yeah, you know, yes, I, if Oregon wants to be an elite team, then, you know, giving up four runs on five hits to Oregon State, given Oregon State's cumulative batting average on the season, you know, that's not an elite pitching performance. And, you know, if, you know, an upgrade probably constitutes having a better pitcher than Reagan Breedlove, you know, if you're listening, I'm sorry. I don't put this loss on Reagan Breedlove.
No,
I put this loss on Oregon plating zero runs.
Right.
That's unacceptable.
And Garcia's pitching for Oregon State was great. I mean, in both
was it?
Games two. Well, it must have been something.
I mean, if Garcia really can pitch two games in a row, then why can't Morgan Scott pitch on Saturday and Sunday?
I don't know, because I mean, I don't know enough about her stamina to know for sure, but I don't really think
that's the reason is what I'm saying. I think,
but, yeah,
I don't think it's about the pitching. I don't think it's about Garcia's pitching. Yeah. I don't think it's about Breedlove's pitching. I think it's about people named Hannah Delgado and Tara McGowan and Allie Bunker and Alyssa Daniels and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, not connecting with the pitching.
Yes.
Like, you know, they weren't hitting.
Right. No, they weren't for two straight games, which is amazing when you think
exactly
about it.
Against not a great pitching staff.
Yes. That's probably the first time that that's happened against somebody who wasn't an elite. I could understand it, you know, against UCLA.
Yeah, it's not like they were hitting it. Fantastic. They did a great job hitting against UCLA. I know that people were like, well, why couldn't they, you know, hit in the clutch? In fact, you wrote an article in which, you know, half of the blame, and like, frankly, I disagreed with you. I thought that was just about the pitching. I think they did a great job hitting, you know, considering that UCLA is a friggin' elite bullpen. I think they did a great job. What I don't think they did a great job hitting was Oregon State. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that means like, you know, they took their eye off the ball, you know, or I don't know, you know, I don't know how much like psychologically it plays into it or motivation or any of this stuff. Like, I'm not the psychologist. Like, you know, I'm not interested in putting any of the ladies on the psychologist's couch here. Like, I don't really care either. You know, I just care about the results, and the results is just like two hits. It's two hits in two games, you know, because the two hits that they got in the other two in game two weren't hits. It was a wild pitch and a walk. Like,
right. Yeah.
I mean, that's completely unacceptable. Like, wild. I don't understand what the excuse is there. I don't know.
It's too cold. I don't know.
What do you think it was?
The fact that it extended over two games is really odd. I mean, I can understand having like an off, like you go into the Sunday game and you've won the series already. You've already won two games. You won the doubleheader on Saturday. I can understand you go into that third game. There's some kind of a letdown by the team. That happens all the time in sports where, you know, you don't think you have to bring your best just because, you know, you've already shown you can beat this team. I can't put my finger on anything in particular the batters were doing that would cause them to not hit the ball, drive the ball as they were, at least in the first game. But you know, clearly something happened there where you've got two straight games, you know, where you only scored two total runs and have three total hits. That is not the way this team has performed at any time, certainly this season, at the plate. And it's just weird.
Well, and then here's the other thing that's like kind of bonkers about it is that, like, you know, so then the next day, like, they drive back down to Eugene to play Montana.
Right. Yeah.
You know, on Monday at noon, you know, like it's like less than, I think, 16 hours since they, you know, finished beating Oregon State. And like, look, Montana has a losing record. So does Oregon State. You know, like, yes, Montana's not that much worse of a team than Oregon State does. And like, they light them up. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, they win that game 9-1, you know,
yeah, six innings. Yeah.
Yeah, like they shut that game on down on mercy rule, you know, and like, and it looks just like every other, you know, game that Oregon plays in which they just like, you know, like everybody's got multiple hits, you know, like everybody's got multiple RBI. It's like the previous two games never happened.
Yeah.
And it's not like they needed a bunch of rest. You know, it's not like they went to the coast and you know, like cleared their mind and did some Zen meditation or whatever. You know, they just just came back and walloped, you know, the next team that they played, you know, like 13 hours later, you know. So like, I don't get it, man. Like, I'm sorry for anybody who tuned into this podcast who's looking for some penetrating analysis about why this happened. Like, you know, all I can tell you is that it did happen. That it was bizarre.
One of those things.
But like, that's it. But you know, but I guess, you know, here's the curveball. Hey, what an apropos metaphor is that, like, you know, we spent this entire time since conference play started and really sort of this ongoing thing over the last like 2 years and like evaluating Melissa Lombardi's time as Oregon's coach, talking about the bullpen, right? Mm-hmm. And like,
yep,
I think Oregon's bullpen has actually performed pretty well over these last four games. I'm pretty happy with Oregon's bullpen. You know, truth be told, they lost a game in which Reagan Breedlove gave up four runs. I just finished saying I don't care. Like, what I do care about is the one thing that I sort of had taken for granted, which is that for two games in the middle of these four, like, the bats disappeared. But like, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to notice that, like, now, you know, because like the game at the beginning and the game at the end, they hit, you know, 10 runs and 9 runs and mercy ruled the team. And then they're going to, you know, so now they have a weird 2-game series against a team called Lindenwood, who I'd never heard of before, which comes from like a little school in Missouri. You know, they only play on Thursday and Friday. You know, they're probably going to clobber them. You know, it's probably going to run rule those, you know, folks too. Although me saying that, you probably means
it jinxes it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. You know, whatever. So like, I guess, you know, I'm not supposed to notice. And like, one of the games wasn't televised that I'm not supposed to notice. Yeah, right. It's like this conspiracy.
What is happening?
Yeah. Right. I don't know. Wild. Man. I don't know.
Yeah. I can't, it's, you know, it's one of the, I guess you just have to chalk it up to one of those things that happens, but it's just bizarre that it was, you know, basically 14 straight innings where nobody could hit the ball.
Yeah.
And that's a long, I mean, it's one thing to go a couple of innings where, you know, the pitcher's hot or, you know, you're not feeling it or whatever, but, you know, two straight games, is a long time in college softball to go with basically,
but it's, But it's no bracketed hits. By 14 innings yeah. in which yeah. no one can stop hitting the ball.
Right. Like, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So, it beats me. All right, that's enough. Let's stop. Let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk some baseball. All right, well, there is definitely one team that can definitely just never stop hitting the ball, which is the yeah. Oregon baseball team. Good Lord.
Yeah. What a performance in Arizona.
Yeah, so they go down to Tucson and just humiliate the Wildcats. So funny background, Arizona courageously somehow takes on like Grand Canyon, which is not like a correspondence college, I swear. But their coach gets ejected for arguing with the ump somehow and has to right. serve like a 2-game suspension. So their pitching coach is their interim coach. And they're like, Arizona's pitching might be the worst pitching I've ever seen. Like somehow worse than Oregon's pitching. Like poor Logan Mercado for Oregon, who's one of their primary pitchers, has, I think, like a 7.67 ERA, which I think is like the worst yeah. pitching like stat that I've ever seen in my life. But the thing is about Oregon's bullpen is that they've got like 12 pitchers. And they just like right. somebody pitches like half an inning and he gets pulled. And it's just like,
yeah, there's fine. Somebody good there somewhere. We just got to yeah, find
like
the
we
guy.
Just got to keep rotating
got it
through.
Going for that day.
Yeah, yeah. Like this is what I dig about Waz is just like, yeah, we're going to have like 7 guys pitch during a game. I'll find somebody good. Like it was funny at some point, like Malaris comes in. Malaris at this point still has a 0 ERA. He closes the game and like he cannot throw a pitch to save his life. Like they're completely wild pitches. But Arizona is so desperate to get a hit that like they're swinging at everything. And yeah. so like this guy who has no control over his pitch still finishes the game with the save and a 0 ERA. And on the stat book, he looks like a genius, but like,
yeah, right.
I mean, I'm
if
sure
you actually
he was
watched
not,
it.
If you actually watched it, he looked drunk. Like it was crazy. So anyway, getting ahead of myself. So they go down to Tucson on Friday, just completely clobber them, just 15-3. And it was just, I mean, that game's not even worth talking about. It just humiliated them.
They just
them.
Jumped on them.
I mean, it was from the get-go too. It was like 7 runs in the second inning. And I mean, it was hilarious. At one point, the Arizona commentator, who was the most like straight-laced commentator I've ever heard, who's great. He's like, just like deadpans. I forget who it was, but actually maybe I can look it up. It was Jacob Walsh, just deadpans. Jacob Walsh singles through the right side for his second RBI of the inning, which I believe is the first time in a lifetime of listening to baseball announcers I've ever heard second RBI of the inning.
Not 2 RBIs in the inning.
Yeah, right. Not a 2-run RBI, but second RBI of the inning. They went all the way through the batting cycle.
Oh, man. And there were still enough guys RBI. On base for him to get another. Yeah.
I know. It was like, do you know what has to happen for the same human being to hit 2 RBIs in the same inning? Like, you're so thoroughly humiliating the pitching staff. And for that to have happened in the second inning, like, yeah. Man, oh man.
So they just anyway. Could not find anybody to throw.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So that's real bad. That's really bad, Arizona. But then somehow it got worse.
Yeah.
So in game two, Jesus Christ. So in game two, Arizona goes up 10-0 by the bottom of the second. It wasn't
exactly the opposite of the first game.
Right. Although not exactly the opposite. It was, I mean, Arizona was hitting the ball, but like it was a bunch of unearned runs. It was sort of like Oregon was screwing up. There were some fielding errors and stuff, which are pretty uncharacteristic. Like, I'm not trying to let Oregon off the hook. It was definitely bad, you know, what was happening. And it was definitely like Oregon, some pitching errors, Oregon, some fielding errors, like, you know, but it's not like Arizona like found another like magic. You know, it's not like Arizona like came to play or something. Like it was, you know, kind of like it was like kind of some fluky. Fluky kind of sounds weird, but like what I'm trying to say is what happened the rest of the game in terms of Arizona's hitting performance didn't exactly surprise me.
Right.
To wit, they got one run in the remaining seven innings. And even that one run, you know, was not that impressive. And it came on Oregon, you know, getting a pretty like awesome double play. So meanwhile, what happens, you know, for the rest of the game is Oregon gets a run in the third, Oregon gets two runs in the fourth, they get two runs in the sixth, they get five runs in the seventh. And in case, you know, you're having a hard time with the math, that means it's now 10 to 11. Oregon gets three runs in the top of the ninth to take the lead. And the deadpan commentator is just devastated. He's like, this is difficult to believe. And so, this is the game that I was talking about where Molaris gets the save and Arizona is just chopping at everything. Like even though they could have just stared at every ball and taken walks and could have maybe like tied the game back up, just walking around the bases. But instead they were just chopping at everything and they lose 13 to 11 in possibly the most humiliating come from behind a victory for the Ducks that I've ever seen. It was great. What did you think about that game, Slurms?
Despite the fact that Arizona is not thought of as one of the top teams in the Pac-12, you're looking at a 10-0 deficit after two innings and you're kind of going, what's going on here? Where were those bats for Oregon that we saw explode yesterday? And then they just go crazy. And it's like, now you're kind of thinking to yourself, you know, after that game, somebody might beat this team by outscoring them somehow, but it didn't seem to me, I mean, the message to me seemed like it was there is no lead that's safe. Yeah. Against this team. They really, even, you know, they were still down 11-5 with four innings to play and still managed to win the game. It was just an incredible offensive performance that really showed, I thought, a lot of determination on the part of the club to not mail it in after going down so much. They clearly believed that they could win the game regardless of,
you know, yeah, like out. I mean, it's the oldest sports cliche in the book, but like there's no quit, you know, they're just like, yeah, oh, it's a 9-inning game, we're just gonna keep swinging. It also sort of demonstrates why baseball, you know, and softball are sort of, you know, batting is the most important, it is the primary stat. Mm-hmm. Like, because there's, you know, unlike in football and basketball and, you know, just about every other game in which there's ways in which your defense can either score or put your offense in a position to score easily, right?
Right.
You know, there's fast break scores, you know, in basketball, or there's turnover scores in football, or, you know, giving your offense a short field on a turnover, right, you know, or, you know, well, I could list all of them, but you know what they are. But in baseball, there's absolutely no way, you know, all the defense can do is get off the field. That's why batting, you know, is enjoys primacy. And games in which you come back from a 10-0 deficit because there's no such thing as a safe lead. Exactly. And so then the third game is like, you know, it finishes with an 8-5 score, although that's because, you know, Arizona hits three runs in the seventh inning, you know, for most of the game, you know, or, you know, Oregon's, you know, sitting on a pretty comfortable lead because, like, in every inning, basically, they score a run. You know, it's just like, it, you know, they get a couple hits, they score a run. You know, they get a couple hits, they score a run. They get a couple of hits, they score two runs. You know, like, it's just like, you know, they steadily, you know,
hit. Drip, 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 drip.
Yeah, exactly.
You find your team falling farther and farther behind. They're not, like, murdering you or anything, but they're just pulling away. And that's hard to take, I suspect.
It's constant homers. I mean, that's the other thing, right, is that, like, yeah, they, you know, everybody can go yard on this, you know, Jacob, yes, Walsh, Howley, you know,
Ceballos.
Ceballos, I think, has two home runs against Portland that, you know, they've got on while I'm recording this with you. Like, you know, everybody can go yard on this team. Yeah. Like,
There's no rest periods for the pitcher, you know, from the other team where he can say, okay, you know, I can work this batter a little bit and work the zone and I'll be able to get this guy out. But the rest of these guys, it's like in some cases you see him hit home runs off of pitches that they may not have any business swinging at. They're so powerful.
So Oregon's currently throttling the Portland Pilots. It's like 8-1 in the eighth inning right now.
9-1 now in the ninth. Pilots are coming up in their last at bat here.
They've got Oregon State this weekend, shifted a day forward. It's Thursday, Friday, Saturday at home in PK Park. Oregon State's not having a great season. I mean, always sort of a dangerous team, of course. And they, you know, you expect them to take a rivalry game, you know, rivalry series seriously. But like it's a more vulnerable team than they have been in the past. I think, you know, all things considered, Oregon's probably the better team this year.
They've looked very, very good. And you're right. Oregon State has struggled a little bit. Now, admittedly, some of the struggles have come against tougher opponents. But they're struggles nonetheless. And, you know, the Beavers are sitting at 5-7 in the conference, which is very unusual for them at this point in the year.
Honestly, I think that Oregon's played a tougher out-of-conference schedule, too. Like, Oregon State really didn't challenge themselves much in the out-of-conference. And you know, in terms of you know, comparable opponents, you know, Oregon State lost their series to Washington State. Oregon won their series against Washington State. So
right.
All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk some football. So I am continuing my series on the transfers coming into Oregon. I will be publishing an article on Wednesday morning about the two wide receivers coming in, Tez Johnson from Troy and Trayshawn Holden from Alabama. Actually, both of those schools are in the state of Alabama. I'll talk about Chess Johnson first. What interesting guy, actually, of all things, the adoptive brother of Bo Nix. They played on the same high school football team in Pinson, Alabama. Their coach was their father, Patrick Nix, and just, you know, adopted Tez. Keontez is his long name, but full first name, but he goes by Tez. So like back in high school, Bo Nix was throwing touchdown passes to Tez. So it's cool that they got reunited. Tez Johnson was a 2020 recruit. He played he played every game in 2020, but he wasn't really like a primary receiver as a true freshman. And of course, that season didn't count because the COVID holiday. But he got like one or two catches every game. And then in 2021 and 2022, I guess I would say that he was their primary receiver. But the thing that was crazy about watching the film in those two seasons was that like he wasn't on the field half of the time. And then when he was on the field, he wasn't getting targeted much of the time. And yet he was their number one receiver by a wide margin in terms of both like, you know, total number of receptions and total amount of yards. And that's because like he never drops a ball and he gets a huge amount of yards after contact. And like he's built like a slot receiver all day. He's like 5'10", 150 pounds, and you can instantly spot him, you know, in the formation because like he does not look very big at all.
Wondered about that. The thing that stood out to me when I was reading through this, I thought it was a typo. 150 pounds is like,
I mean, like if you saw him walking down, like that's a normal sized human being. If you saw him walking down the street wearing a business suit, you wouldn't think about it at all. But like when he's on the football field with a bunch of gigundo dudes, you're like, he's going to get broken in half. Although I will say, like, I put a clip compilation in my article, including him throwing some blocks. Like he's a pretty feisty dude. Like he's like, don't worry about that at all. Like,
yeah. The size, you know, not the size of the dog. It's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of
You'll get it, Slurms.
Eventually. Maybe next time I'm on the podcast.
Like Like, no, nobody's going to mistake him for a tight end or anything. Like, don't expect him to, like on a screen pass or something, like, maintain a block for 3 seconds while the screen receiver, like, gets out to the sideline. That's probably,
right.
You don't want to do that. But, like, if he needs to maintain a block, like, just for a second for the running back to get through to get a first down, like, I've got a clip in my article of him doing that. You know, he's not going to get broken in half. He's a pretty tough kid. In fact, I had a bunch of clips. I could have put in, you know, ton of clips of him, like, because he got used as like a possession receiver a whole lot. In fact, a sort of a running theme in my write up of it, of his time at Troy, was that I sort of thought that like Troy was misusing him. Like, they should have been using him because his speed is so amazing. Like, he's so fast and he's so elusive and his acceleration is so smooth. They really should have been using him to like take the top off of defenses and using him on deep routes. And they really weren't. They were using him enough for that I could put clips in my article of it to show off like how good he is at it. But like, right. They weren't. Instead, they were using him on like a lot of sort of short route stuff. And which, let me finish the point, which the downside of that for him is that he would catch the ball and then immediately get clobbered by bigger defenders, because everybody on the field is bigger than him, like even the punter, who would be trying to like jar the ball, because like, I can hit this guy so hard, this little kid, you know, so hard that it'll knock the ball out of his hand, but it never happened. So like, good that, you know, he's good like in that regard. But then the other aspect that I thought was really like he was like poorly utilized by Troy was that they were using him on screen passes a ton, just like a ton, where he would catch the ball because of course he did, that's his job. But then Troy was such a terrible screen pass blocking team that like there'd be a dude that they would like forget to block, or just like the block would get blown up. And so he would immediately get tackled for a loss, but it would be tackled for a loss on a passing play, or He'd be used as the sweep man, which like teams over the last 10 years have started using that little push pass. You know what I'm talking about? Where like, Instead of doing the handoff, they push the ball forward like 6 inches, because then if there's a problem with the handoff, it goes down as an incomplete pass instead of a fumble. Right. But the problem for the stat book is that goes down as a passing play, which like it's one of the benefits of doing film study. And I could go on a long rant about why that means I don't trust stat books. And I don't even trust like a lot of advanced stats that use the raw stats as their like, you know, their inputs, because you know that means that they're using that as a stat play instead of a pass play instead of a run play. But sorry, that's a long rant that I'll spare you. But anyway, so even though this guy, Tez Johnson, is Troy's like leading receiver by huge margins, if you look up his stat line and you're like, wait a minute, why does this guy in 2021 only have 11 yards per completion and only have 15.4 yards per completion in 2022, 11 yards in 2021 and 15.4 in 2022? The answer is because he keeps getting used as a sweep, as a pass play, and a screen in which he gets negative yardage plays because the sweeps and screens keep getting blown up through no fault of his own, because the blocking is so bad. And Troy should stop calling these plays and instead should be calling like downfield passing plays for him. And it's sort of this running theme of the article. Well, it's sort of a running theme of all of my transfer articles that I think this dude is being misused or underused by.
That's because why like he's leaving or whatever.
Yeah, right. Like, of course, it's going to be a theme of my transfer articles. Sure. Like, you know, I try not to hit it too hard because I feel like the reader would grow sick of me, you know, saying that. Although, spoiler alert, when I write about Tysheem Johnson for Ole Miss's defense, it's going to be really hard to contain it. I hate that defense, but that's next week. Tez Johnson's numbers are unfairly curtailed by the offense that he was used in. And however, since I got to chart all of his plays, I can just pull out all the screen passes and sweeps and just look at his downfield only passing plays.
Yeah.
And when I do that, you know what happens to his yards per reception? It jumps up to 22.3.
Wow.
every time you throw Tez Johnson the ball and the ball crosses the line of scrimmage before he catches it, you gain 22.3 yards.
Dang.
And Pro Football Focus College, which I actually don't really love as an organization. I don't really understand how they gather their stats, which because they're opaque about it, but they rank him as the number two receiver in the country on their grading system behind Marvin Harrison Jr. at Ohio State. Because of his route running and because of his yards after catch, he's so good at it. And like, I've got tons of clips in my article, and you will immediately understand on reading my article why, you know, I agree with Pro Football Focus about his route running, but why his stat line doesn't bear that out. And it's because his stat line it's like his light is being concealed under the bushel of all of those horrible, horrible screen passes and sweeps. And I tried not to like burden down my article too much. Like, oh man, like an early version of my article had a bunch, like, oh man, I've got so many plays tagged on my tally sheet of like, you know, you know, I could have, you know, put a bunch of clips in my article of other Troy, you know, receivers and tight ends who should have been doing a good job blocking, but instead they weren't, and getting right. blown up by like Sunbelt defenders. Jeez. You know, but like, yeah, like who's, you know, who would that Seriously. Serve? You know, like, it's not like those yeah. guys are getting NIL deals, you know, like,
yeah, exactly.
It's not like, you know, the Mercedes-Benz dealership of Troy, Alabama is sponsoring that guy. You know? Yeah. Like, he doesn't deserve to have his crappy blocking exposed on the internet. But if anybody thinks I'm fabricating that, I guess I have all the timestamps. You can contact me. Yeah.
I'd be happy to show
you. I mean, why would I lie about this? You know, but I swear, like, it really is. His stats are dragged down by that. And he really is just an absolutely phenomenal yards after catch receiver. And I have clip after clip after clip in my article. So read it. It's very enjoyable to watch.
He looks very fast on the video.
Oh yeah. And it's not just fast, because there's like a bunch of different kinds of fast, and he's right. like all of sure. the different kinds of fast. Yeah. But it's like quick the acceleration.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's so smooth and he's so elusive. And it just makes defenses look silly. Like the way that he, like, I went out of my way to find clips in which he's like weaving through defenses.
Yes.
And getting like yards after, cause it's not just like, cause like, frankly, I didn't really love his offense and I really didn't love his quarterback. In fact, I have an entire clip compilation in the article in which he's adjusting on the ball cause the ball's poorly thrown. It's like, this would have been a touchdown if the ball was placed properly, but instead, and because he totally cooked the cornerback, but instead he has to run back 7 yards to catch this totally underthrown ball, but he caught it anyway for 45 yards. So like, awesome. You know, I should hope that won't be a problem with Bo Nix and I'll be catching touchdowns instead, but like, yeah. So anyway, so yeah, I like Tez Johnson. I think he's gonna work out pretty well. So then Trayshon Holden's the other guy, the other half of the article. Trayshon Johnson, sort of your classic outside receiver. You know, he's a big guy. You know, 4-star, Alabama recruited him for a reason. You know, it's interesting. So in 2021, he's like the 6th leading receiver because, you know, he's behind a bunch of NFL dudes, right? You know, right. You totally expect that to be the case, right? Like Alabama sent like, I think their top 4 pass catchers to the NFL at the end of the 2021 season. So it's like, well, yeah, you know, yeah.
being 6th on that crew is not that terrible.
Yeah, really. Exactly. It's just like, and so in 2022, you're just like, well, okay, Trayshon, you know, your turn. Right. And so for like the first 5 games, it absolutely looks like that, you know, like, and Bryce Young wins the Heisman, you know, in 2021, that's the other thing, their quarterback. And so, you know, and, you know, he's catching passes and he looks good. Like I got a bunch of clips in which he's, you know, he's catching these, you know, these timing routes and these comeback routes. And like, he looks good, you know, no, it's no complaints at all. But there's a couple things that sort of happen that are sort of worth noting. Number one, is there's something weird about the offensive line. Like the offensive line is not blocking well for Alabama, which is like weird, you know, for an SEC team, you know, much less Alabama. And like Bryce Young is like running a lot. And actually I put a whole clip compilation in my article about like, which is a weird thing to put in my article, about like Trayshon Holden's a good guy to have on the scramble drill. Like he like watches the quarterback and like tries to mirror him to be like, hey, I'm open, dude, throw it to me, you know, or like, oh, you're running, I'll go throw a block for you, dude. So like, that's good. But also the fact that I had so many clips to choose from of him being a good guy on a scramble drill should probably tell you something about something was wrong here. You know,
that's not how that play was supposed to work.
Number two is that the 2 years he was at Alabama coincide with the 2 years that Bill O'Brien was the offensive coordinator at Alabama, in which every Alabama fan wanted Bill O'Brien fired. And then he sort of eventually was, or he went to the Patriots, but like, and like I included a clip in which like an Alabama fan starts screaming at Bill O'Brien. Yeah. And he starts screaming back. It was pretty funny. And like Bill O'Brien just wants to throw the ball to the running back who like they got a running back from Georgia Tech, Jahmyr Gibbs, who's really good. But like Jahmyr Gibbs becomes their leading receiver and like he doesn't want to throw the ball downfield. And it was like crazy. So like sort of makes it difficult to evaluate Trayshon Holden because like the ball never gets thrown to Trayshon Holden between like Bryce Young scrambling for his life all the time. And the fact that like Bill O'Brien only wants to throw the ball to the running back. And like he wants to run like 12 personnel offenses and 6 offensive lineman offenses. So like Trayshon Holden's only on the field like 50% of the time. And even when he's on the field, like you can tell from the way that Bill O'Brien structures the offense that like, so it's a lot of like when there's 4 receivers on the field, it's a lot of 3-by-1 sets, meaning like 3 wide receivers on one side of the field and 1 wide receiver on the other side of the field. And Holden will be the one in the 3-by-1. And he'll be running just like straight down the field and the quarterback will be, his progression will be the 3 guys on the other side of the field. So he's not even looking at Trayshon Holden. Like he's not even in the progression. So like, it's not just Holden's not getting targeted. It's he's not even getting looked at, which means
he's using a decoy mostly.
Well, yeah, or which, yeah, I mean, that's obnoxious, but it also means it's I would understand why Holden would find that obnoxious and would want to transfer out of that. Yeah. But also it's obnoxious to me as a film reviewer because like I am not getting film on how well he is generating separation from the defensive back who's covering him because the camera doesn't look his way.
Right.
Like I have almost no film on how well Trayshon Holden generates separation from defensive backs. Like, I don't know how good he is as a wide receiver. Like I would have, if you told me sight unseen that I was getting a low 3-star slot receiver from G5 Troy as a transfer and a 4-star from Alabama, you know, X receiver, and I need to write, you know, and one of them was going to get top billing, one of them was going to get second billing, I would be like, well, the Alabama guy's obviously going to get top billing. Nope, he's not. He's getting second billing. And the reason is not because I think that Trayshon Holden sucks. The reason is because I've got almost no film on Trayshon Holden for the reasons that I've given about Bill O'Brien and the way that he was used. And then the other thing is that like he sort of like gets systematically marginalized. He winds up sitting out 2 different games in November, you know, as the offense gets like increasingly like, you know, it's just the Jahmyr Gibbs and 6 offensive linemen and 2 tight ends show. He makes a couple of mistakes like everybody does, you know, it's, you know, like other wide receivers make mistakes on Alabama, but when other wide receivers make a mistake, like they miss a block or whatever, or they drop a pass, which like, you know, he drops a couple passes. Everybody drops passes, you know, like he doesn't drop passes at a rate that's greater than everybody else. But when another Alabama wide receiver drops a pass, he's in on the next play. When Trayshon Holden drops a pass, he misses the next 4 drives.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, they want to punish him. I don't know. I just said that, but I instantly want to retract it because I don't know. Like, I understand there's a possibility of something of stuff like personality conflicts or off the field issues. I understand that, like, Dan Lanning kicked him off the team after an arrest or a gun issue or something like that. And then, and then he was reinstated onto the team, which, like, I never really got a full picture. There's a crazy story from 2020 in which he was on the LSU campus, like, I think visiting a friend, and the LSU campus police wind up pulling guns on him and his friend.
Oh, geez.
And are like, where are your guns and drugs? The LSU campus police wind up getting suspended over this for being, like, I don't know, racists or some shit. Which, like, Southern cops got suspended for something, like, you know, something tinky.
Right.
Like, yeah,
Worse than average.
Right. So, like, part of me is like, I don't know, maybe Trayshon Holden sort of brought all this stuff on himself. But then another part of me is just like, maybe this dude is just like the unluckiest dude in the world. Like, maybe all of this is just like totally snake bit and he just wants a change of scenery, you know, like, because
that is crazy, though, that they'd sit him for a single mistake that harshly.
Yeah, that's just odd. But, like, I don't know. Like, maybe in the locker room he's being obnoxious and they're like, I'm sick of this guy. Like, sit him, you know. But I don't know. Like, this is pure speculation. I have no way of knowing any of these things. All I can do is watch the film. And then what I'm complaining about is that, like, I watched 2 years worth of film on the guy and I barely had enough to fill 4 film compilations. You know, what I saw looked good. You know, what I saw looked like, you know, Power 5, you know, elite starting receiver who's a 4-star, you know. So, like, I don't get it. Like, I really don't. Of all the transfers that I've written about, it's the guy and will write about, you know, because I got 2 more to go, Evan Williams and Tysheem Johnson, the DBs. He's the guy that I've still got the most question marks because the film is so, like, the film is so scanty, but what I saw was so good, but then it doesn't make sense why the film is so scanty given that it was so good. Like, right. It just doesn't make. So anyway, I gave you what I got, and, you know, you can make up your mind and you'll get to see him in the spring game and we'll just see. But it really beats me. It's hard to understand. But like I said, from what I saw, I liked it. I thought, you know, and blocking. That was another thing I saw on some Alabama message boards that, like, some fans were like, boy, you know, he doesn't seem like a very enthusiastic blocker. And so I was like watching for that. And like, it's true that when he's like on the opposite side of the play, he's sort of like doing that desultory blocking thing. He's like, playing patty cake thing. But like everybody does that.
Yeah,
when they're on the opposite side, when they're not really part of the play. Because like, are you kidding me? That's not a good use of your energy to be like trying to go Hulkamaniac on a dude when like your block doesn't matter. Like you're just going to exhaust yourself. And then when it is time for you to do something for real, like you don't have the tiger in the tank. Like that's, you know, but when it was time for him to throw a real block, he was ferocious and throwing great blocks. And I put clips in my article of it. So like, I don't really think that's a fair knock on him, but I don't know. Maybe Nick Saban hated that. And maybe Nick Saban wants him to do it 100%. I don't know. Again, 100% speculation. I have no way of knowing these things about, like, you know, how he was evaluated at Alabama.
That'll be one of the fun things about spring ball and then fall is to see some of this. You know, you don't know anything about him. It'll be interesting to learn whether he's the guy that had the good receiving and the good blocking or he's some other guy.
Yeah.
You don't know yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've gone through 8 guys worth of tape, or actually at like 7.5. I'm not quite done with Evan Williams tape yet. But I'm almost done with 8 guys worth of tape and I don't have question marks on any of them really. Like I feel very confident in my assessment of them with the exception of Trayshon Holden. Like he's really the mystery man out of all of them. Well, I guess there are two others that are mystery men, you know, in the sense that I just wasn't able to acquire tape on them at all. And those are Johnny Cornelius and the other Alabama transfer, the cornerback, whose name's escaping me right now. Sorry, buddy. Who's a backup cornerback and like, forget it. Like, just not nearly enough film to do even close to an evaluation on that guy. But anyway, that article is going up on Wednesday. I certainly had plenty of film on Tez Johnson. It's a treat to watch. And what I was able to acquire of Trayshawn Holden is fun to watch too. So like, it was an enjoyable, article in that sense. And I think everybody should have fun. I believe that both of those guys have been fully healthy for practices and should be 100% good to go for the spring game on the 29th. So, should be some good questions answered. I think there should be a pretty healthy competition at wide receiver. I think we should be treated to a real fireworks show at that position. Like, I don't think that position is settled at all. And the guys that they took at wide, you know, like, I think it's a pretty good wide receiver room, and they took some dynamite guys at wide receiver. So it's like, you know, unlike positions where they took some transfers and it's like, well, I know why they took transfers at that position. You know, I can pretty much slot that guy in as the starter, you know. Not so much true at wide receiver. They took some guys who, they look really good, but at the same time, they're going to be a real fight, you know, for minutes. So
that's great. That's good for the room, you know, to get that competition going. So,
So it should be pretty exciting. That's coming up on the 29th, the last of the Pac-12 spring games. So that article, the wide receiver transfer article, will be published on Wednesday, pretty much like half an hour after this podcast drops. And then I'll have my DBs article on Evan Williams and Tysheem Johnson the week after that. And then spring games, the Pac-12 spring games start on the 15th. So I'll start my Pac-12 previews, shortly thereafter. We'll roll through the entire Pac-12 and finish up with Oregon, because Oregon gets to go last this year. They're the only one on the 29th. And we'll see how that goes.
Sounds great.
Well, we'll wrap it up there. Any parting words of wisdom for us, Slurms?
No, just looking forward to some more great baseball and softball action this week.
Yeah, so Lindenwood for the softball team and hosting Oregon State for the baseball team. Looking like a little bit of weather, but nothing should interfere with the games. But of course, it never rains on this podcast.